Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshanworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society, and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures.
I'm Ed Powell, CEO of TensorX, where we leverage the cloud, the crowd, and AI to inform strategy, drive innovation, and optimize performance. I'm joined today by my co-host, James Villarubia, White House Presidential Innovations Fellow and Digital Strategist for NASA's CAST project. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be here. And hello, everyone. As Ed mentioned, I'm a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I'm helping the teams there use AI in their everyday projects and hopefully advance scientific research with AI. So really excited to have our guests today and dig into how AI is shaping healthcare and the ecosystem at large. Back to you, Ed.
Yeah, we're excited today to welcome Steve Schwartz to the podcast, startup founder and CTO and owner of Alpha Django. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Ed and James. Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited.
So, Steve, if you would, just provide a kind of an overview of your thoughts on AI. Remember, we have an audience that's thinking heavily these days about AI and hearing a lot about it, but it would be great if you could provide just a general overview.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to start, is especially when talking to people who are hearing a lot about AI more recently, maybe haven't actually done any engineering or technical deep dives, maybe they're non-technical in general. I think one of the confusing things can be the fact that AI has been around for 50, 60 years. You know, the term artificial intelligence was coined in the 1950s. So it's been around for a long time. And I think one of the things that also confuses people is that there's this sort of underlying subtext of different definitions of what artificial intelligence really is. And that's not, I was going to say that's not an accident. It kind of is an accident that that's happened. Essentially, what's happened is over the past 50, 60 years, as our technology, the different types of technology that we call artificial intelligence, as the technology has progressed, as we've made new discoveries, in parallel with that, we've also been doing a lot of neurological and psychological research, and our definitions of intelligence, just actual intelligence, has evolved over time. And so you've had these two things happening alongside each other for 50, 60 years now, and it's, well, I guess 70 years now, sorry, I'm like 70 years now, where you get the words actually evolving in their definitions as the technology that they describe evolves. And you end up in a place where there's no one specific definition of artificial intelligence on which everyone has landed and agreed upon. And so I think just kind of getting that out of the way, if things are confusing where people say AI and you're like, I don't really get which technology AI is, that's because there's no one consensus. It can mean a lot of things. And the definition I've found most helpful to follow is the sort of general statement that artificial intelligence is when machines do something that typically requires thought. The problem is that definition is so vague that it often is not very useful, but welcome to the world of AI.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're describing is sort of the way people describe sort of cuisine. It's like, oh, it's high cuisine. It's culinary. The chef went to the greatest school. It's like, oh, but what kind of food are they serving? It's like, oh, well, that's actually like, there's a lot of differences. It's French, it's American, it's bistro, gastro, pub, whatever, fusion, whatever might be out there. And I think it sounds like you're describing sort of an AI community where there is this broader term, but underneath it has been a lot of advancement in very specific categories at different times. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, absolutely. You can always get into the differences between narrow AI versus general AI and things like that. One of the examples I like to pose, just for the sake of argument, is I like to argue that by some definitions of AI, a coin sorting machine counts. It's literally a machine that does something that typically requires thought, which is sorting your coins into distinct piles, the vast majority of people would not agree that a coin sorting machine counts as AI, but it could. I could probably make a cogent argument that it counts. And I just do that to make the point that there's a broad range that AI could cover. There's a lot more examples that you wouldn't necessarily think that a lot of people actually would agree count as AI. One of my favorite AI applications from the 90s is Microsoft Office's Clippy. It's an export system. It counts. It's AI. And so AI is just very broad.
And I think that sort of speaks to the concerns that a lot of the AI community has had for a while, in that the definition has changed, but also people sort of referring to ChatGPT or sort of the larger, more recent LLMs, like, oh, that's AI, and there's their synonyms. Like, well, AI is like around for a while, a term, and sort of people now sort of lumping in just the latest and greatest. Oh, that's AI. Nothing else is, has been sort of frustrating. But I do want to dig into your background a little bit, Steve, and maybe sort of talk a little bit about sort of your work at Genomenon. I know you've been in the healthcare space for a while, and I see that they are doing some work in data science around genetics. Can you sort of explain a little bit about sort of that your company and sort of the role that AI is taking at that company, and maybe some of your prior roles, and we can sort of dig into the healthcare space more specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been doing software development for about 20 years now, founding startups for about 15 years. So my third startup was traditional software. It was software for car dealerships, and we got acquired in 2014 by Edmunds.com. It was around that time that I had met my soon-to-be co-founder, Mark Keel, at the University of Michigan, where we would found Genomenon. And so Genomenon, I typically describe as genomic interpretation software for helping diagnose and treat cancer and rare disease in children. But really what it did was we indexed the genomic knowledge from the medical literature. So we were at that sort of intersection of natural language processing and something that we like to call genomic language processing. And I like to call it that because it actually tended to be simpler than natural language processing. In natural language, you can express one single idea thousands of different ways. In scientific language, there's typically only a handful of ways to describe a concrete idea using the established conventions and connotations of words that the scientific community has agreed upon. It's similar to legal language in contracts, right? Like, there's a lot of ways you could say this, but there's one way that the industry has established that means this specific thing, this specific idea that you're trying to describe. And if you don't use that established language, then even other experts reading what you wrote won't necessarily know exactly what you meant. And so scientific language, and more specifically genomic language used in studies and peer-reviewed papers, tends to be a bit simpler in how it expresses ideas. The ideas are extremely complicated, but the way that you describe them with words is there's a set of words. There's like a bag of words you pick from, and that's what this concept, you always use these words, and this concept, you always use these words. And so if you took that approach, it ended up being a little bit simpler.
So a decade or so ago, there was an analysis that was done on Science and Nature articles and found that only about 62% of the results could be replicated. So when you were analyzing the data on this genomic research, did you do anything to try to figure out which of those papers were actually generating true results versus false results? And did you use something like referential analysis, or what were the approaches that were taken to try to eliminate or separate the high quality papers from the lower quality papers?
Yeah, that's a really great question. It's funny because it's somewhat related to a conversation I had with a friend of mine a few months ago, where we were talking about the concept of being able to judge the quality of a given research paper. And we, of course, it was one of my best friends that I've known for like two decades now. So of course, we went off onto a whole tangent about the philosophical definitions of truth. But you know, one of the things that we were talking about was this idea that, let's say you have five research papers that say this is true, and then you have five other research papers that say this is not true. How do you know which one is correct when your only frame of reference is each other? And one of the arguments I made is that's actually not your only frame of reference. Another frame of reference you can use is the paper itself, the internal consistency of the paper itself. If a given paper makes an assertion on page 2 that's contradicted by another assertion it makes on page 8, that's a good indication that there's something up with that paper that might come down to the quality of the study or the methodology design or something like that. I guess all of that is to say there's a lot of things you can do with that. Another really interesting way to evaluate papers is to redo all the math that's presented in the paper. There's been meta studies that run through all the numbers of papers and find calculation errors in papers where they'll say, for example, that they did a study with 232 people, and then somewhere at the end of it, they'll say 17% of people had this. And when you run the math, you realize there's no way, like, people aren't divisible, so that any division of the people has to be a whole number. And you realize that there's no whole number way of dividing the people that gives you 17%. I don't know if that's true. I just made those numbers up. But that's the sort of reference that you get. So it's not only papers that aren't reproducible, but papers that don't even seem to have plausible math laid out in them, just given the information that was described in the paper. And so this is a big problem with papers that don't include their source data, which sort of affects basically every industry that has peer-reviewed literature. To answer your question, no, we had not gotten into that yet. One of the directions I did want to start moving was being able to connect papers, for example, a paper that retracts another paper or contradicts another paper. So rather than making the determination that this is a low-quality paper, we would make it so that there was no way to see that paper without also seeing that someone's disputing.
That's really interesting. Sort of a network, just mapping the network ontology as you might in sort of typical AI studies. You're actually sort of informing the quality of that network sort of retroactively. It's a really great idea. So it sounds like you have been in a lot of spaces, from car sales and software. I mean, this is as you and I talked before the show, the life of a software engineer. You get to work in lots of different fields if you have the skills that can be applied in lots of different fields. So you've worked in sort of the car sales and automation space, and now in genomics, which seem, you know, wildly disconnected, but it seems like there's probably actually a lot to be learned there in terms of how we talk about AI, how we talk about technology. But I think the healthcare space, since it's more recent and probably has more sort of ethical conundrums buried in it, can you talk about your experience and your perspectives with AI in healthcare, how it sort of moved along through time, sort of its evolution, and maybe sort of where we are today, given the current sort of excitement and panic around AI, particularly generative AI?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I would start probably from a really high level and say, typically when I talk about AI, I've created for myself what I call the AI universe. I was really into comics as a kid, so Marvel, Cinematic Universe, all that kind of stuff. So I like to call it the AI universe, which is everything AI, every technology that could conceivably be considered AI. And I sort of lay it out as this complicated, like Venn or Euler diagram, like circles that are, some are subcircles of others, some have various amounts of overlap with other circles. But essentially, I divide all AI into a few different types that then further get subdivided. So I start out with the big circles of machine learning, natural language processing, expert systems, and then I have a sort of other where I include things like vision systems and autonomous machines. And the only reason I put them in other is because my background is largely software. So when I think about AI, I'm thinking about a lot of software AI. I'm thinking less about the physical world, although that is also something that's very interesting to me. It's just not something I've been largely involved in since the mobile robotics team I was on back in college. But essentially, I start out with this machine learning, natural language processing, expert systems, and the ways that they all overlap and intersect. And one of the things that sort of relates to your question there is this sort of idea of opacity of a given AI system. And what I mean by that is, how much does it function like a black box versus traditional software, where you can drill down to the specific line of code that causes this particular output from this input or this behavior? And so there's a whole science behind the ability to perform like introspection of machine learning models and AI systems in different technologies, different AI technologies, obviously have vastly different profiles and how well we can understand them today, given the extent of our knowledge and the development tools that we have to assist with that. And so there's some things that are really easy to sort of introspect. Numerical predictions, like we have some data, and if you put them in the right plot with the right axes, you actually get kind of a trend line. And then we can use that trend line to predict things that are covered by our current data set. Those things are relatively easy to understand. When you get an outlier, you can start to dig in and figure out, well, my prediction is taking into account these data points, these characteristics of the system. My outlier has this weird combination that wasn't accounted for. And so that explains why it's not performing as expected. In the machine learning side, we've gotten into more and more complex technologies. So we started with these sort of what's called regressions, which are just numerical prediction. You draw a trend line on some data and then you use that. We've gotten more into things like neural networks and then different types of neural networks, recurrent neural networks, combinatorial neural networks, transformer-based neural networks is the newest hype. Neural networks are really complicated to the point that all but the sort of smallest and simplest ones are difficult to understand what they're doing inside that black box. So one of the ways that I've found helpful to understand why a neural network is so complicated is that basically it takes input and it divides the input into a bunch of different nodes. And when you build the neural network, it gets to decide what constitutes a distinction between this node and this node. And it often doesn't map to things like we understand it. Like if I gave you a picture of a dog that has a bone in its mouth in the middle of a field with flowers, and I told you, divide this picture into its constituent pieces, you would say, okay, well, I would have, like, imagine you're trying to take this picture and divide it into layers that you can overlay on top of each other to end up with the picture. And you'd say, okay, well, I probably have a layer that has the field. I'd add a layer with flowers in the field. Then I'd add a layer with a dog. And then I'd add a layer that has a bone in its mouth. Neural networks don't do that. Neural networks say, here's all the black pixels. Here's all the yellow pixels. Here's all the grayish pixels. And you end up with these nodes where if you drew the picture that each node was aware of, you would very likely end up with not a single node out of millions or billions of nodes that has any recognizable picture in it. But it makes sense to the neural network. And that's how it finds patterns in pictures, is it sort of pulls them apart into a number of layers that's hard for us to conceive, and not a single layer in isolation would make sense to us. And yet somehow, it's able to do that in a way that results in the neural network being able to figure out there's a dog in this picture, there's a bone in this picture, whatever labels you want it to figure out from a given set of pictures. So I guess the point to all that, to finally bring that back around to your question, is as the technologies have gotten more and more complicated, our ability to understand why they're so effective has decreased more and more recently, to the point where we end up with models that perform better than any of the understandable models we've ever had. And yet we can't quite figure out why they perform so well. They just do. And that can lead to a recipe for potential disaster in some applications, because if you can't fully understand why a given model, like a neural network, for example, is making the decisions it's making, then you can't really predict the types of decisions it will make in the future. It could work better than anything we've ever seen, all the way up until it gets to this scenario where it just goes way off the deep end in a way that we couldn't have predicted until it happened. And so I think that's the area when we talk about generative language models, which is the sort of topic of the past year, OpenAI's ChatGPT, Meta or Facebook's Llama model. Google has just released Gemini, which is part of like Bard and all of that. They're really amazing in their capabilities, but they're extremely opaque. And I think there's already been a lot of scenarios where they fail tremendously and we can't really make sense of why
necessarily. So to put that into the healthcare terms, I think, for our audience.
Yeah.
So it sounds like in sort of older models, we could have a prediction, we'd have an outcome that sort of didn't match our prediction, and then we sort of reason backwards, say, okay, where did our model go wrong? In sort of the new world, the instances where the model might go wrong are rarer. So now instead of being 1%, it might be 0.1%. So one in every 1,000 patients has a strange outcome. But we can't reason back. We can't figure out why the model made this sort of wrong adjustment. It's sort of impossible. So the trade-off is sort of understanding that accountability and a sort of traceability of why it made the decision versus the improved performance that you get. And that from an ethics standpoint, from a risk standpoint, when you're a doctor, you're trying to, I want to know what I'm getting myself into, what my patient is getting into, but I also want to maximize the chances of their sort of outcomes being positive. Is that a fair sort of statement of how the ecosystem has shifted into these black box models?
Yeah. And I think to some degree, further to that, to some degree, the way that large language models work based on this whole transformer architecture for the neural network, there's a lot of jargon here, but essentially the way that they work is they find patterns between words, like they find patterns in language. To the extent that they seem to be able to reason and logic through things, that's a sort of, it's an emergent behavior that they weren't designed to do. And so to some degree, a lot of this unpredictability can't really be taken out of large language models. Like that's literally part of their architecture. It's part of their design. But what we will see is the layering of other types of AI on top of them. What you can do is you can ask a large language model to give you an answer, and you can then compare that answer, for example, with a database of acceptable answers. And you can sort of combine these systems in a way that help pull out the incorrect answers, what's called hallucinations and the technical jargon. But it's essentially when a large language model tells you something that's not true. There's ways that you can layer in other technologies to help solve for some of those things. And I think that's what it comes down to, is we're going to see more and more complex systems that mix more and more types of technologies, where you have this technology that's really good at this thing, but will always be really bad at this thing. And you can either try to brute force and change the technology to not be bad at that thing, or you can just combine it with another technology that's not bad at that thing and have them work together. And I think that's what we'll start seeing a lot more of, especially in healthcare. There's going to be combinations of large language models and expert systems, which is the technology that formed the basis of Microsoft's Clippy. So having like Clippy fact check an LLM will essentially be one of the solutions you see.
Yeah. So as we think about this, I mean, first of all, it's been a great overview. One thing that would be interesting to think about is what were kind of the punctuated equilibrium points in the development when you go from the perceptron to the networks become more complicated. You introduce back propagation, which now allows you to train the network, which had never been done before. What do you see as kind of the key developments and why it appears that there's so much interest in the rapid evolution now with these latest kind of punctuations in that equilibrium?
Yeah, I would say obviously with large language models and the whole thing is transformers. The attention is all you need paper that was published in 2017 that showed how widely applicable this idea of attention is. And so attention is, if you think about, again, going back to my sort of AI universe, you've got machine learning, you've got natural language processing are two of the big circles. And then where one of the areas where they overlap is if you go from machine learning to neural networks to GPT or transformer-based neural networks, and then over natural language processing, you've got understanding versus generative. If you drill down into generative, you've got language models that try to map like the more complicated aspects of linguistic rules. And so then the intersection of like language models that are trained with transformer-based neural networks, that's what we mean by large language models. Like that's the dictionary definition of a large language model. So obviously the main thing based on that is this idea of attention and transformers. If you think of it from the language processing side, the natural language processing side, what ends up happening is it's a lot of math on how we assemble words in language, right? So you've got this word tends to happen right next to this word. I'm trying not to use my hands too much because I know the listeners can't see my hands. But if you've got word A, is next to word B, then there's some sort of implied relationship between word A and word B. However, that can often lead, so a really naive approach to language processing is predicting the next word based on your current word. If I say I, the maybe the most likely next word that I'm going to say is am. The problem is you can easily get into circles. You can get into a circle where if you say word A, the most likely next word is B. But by analyzing written language, if you have B, the most likely next word is A. And you can get into an endless loop where the processing model spits out A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, and it makes no sense. So obviously you get better when you understand not just the word that came before, but the context, i.e. the word before it. And you get even better if you can see the word before that. And you get even better if you can see the word before that. Like if you can see the last three words before the next word you're predicting, that's better than if you can only see the last two. And if you can see the last 10, that's even better than the last three. And if you can see the last 20, that's even better than the last 10. The problem is the amount of compute power that takes and memory that it takes to keep all of that in the context of the prediction algorithm skyrockets very quickly, grows exponentially. And so essentially what happened was this concept of attention, the concept that when I'm predicting the next word, the last word might actually not be the most important one. It might be three words ago. So an example of that, if you have a sentence that says, the boy ran and you're trying to predict the next word, it could be he or her. And the only way you know, or he or she, and the only way to know would be to rewind in the sentence until you got to the word boy. The word boy is actually the most important word in that sentence for predicting the next one. And it's like, what, four or five words ago. And so that's what attention is. Attention is the ability to say, I'm more interested in five words ago than I am in one, two, three, or four words ago. And so essentially that's what the transformer is. It sort of encodes everything you've encountered up until the next word as like a token, as a symbol, so that it doesn't take up so much processing power and RAM to keep every word in memory. And so the reason, I guess, that I went through all of that is to say, I think that's the big advancement that we've seen with generative language models is this idea of attention. And what gets really interesting in the healthcare space is how many other areas this concept of attention, the concept of being able to figure out what in the data is most important that might not be the most recent piece of the data, how often that applies to other things. So for example, in genomics, if you look at the sort of inflection points in the data, like which parts of the data are most significant in predicting the next thing, if you send a transformer-based neural network, if you put that on the job of learning from the training data, you end up with a lot of these attention mechanisms corresponding to real things in biology. In genomics, you can figure out that the most important thing for predicting the next nucleotide isn't the one before it in the DNA. It's actually the one 26 nucleotides before it. Why is that? Because that's where the splice junction was. So the neural network doesn't know anything about biology or what splice sites are or anything like that. It just learns that when you have this kind of thing that occurs here, then you tend to have this kind of thing that comes out of it, 25, 100 nucleotides down the sequence. And that's what gets really interesting in healthcare with generative things. It's not just with language, but how often it ends up applying to other fields where you get natural phenomena being represented by the transformers.
So it's interesting.
I want to sort of step back because I think we've gone down a little bit down the rabbit hole, and I want to make sure our audience can understand this from the context of maybe some business propositions. Where have you seen AI in sort of healthcare go right or go wrong? Because obviously the ecosystem is changing really rapidly. So like what might have been sort of best practice 5 years ago now seems sort of silly. And there's a hype cycle going on right now with generative AI, and I sort of see where that might go in the future. But I just want to, do you have any good examples that you've seen in your work, good and bad, of sort of how AI has been used that people might sort of keep in their minds?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing to know, I guess, before answering the question systemically, is it's often hard to figure out exactly what technologies are happening under the hood when you have a company saying that they're using AI. As I mentioned, there's lots of different types of AI that range from very simple and easy to understand to very complicated and impossible to understand, even for the experts who invented or are creating the systems. And there was a study I remember reading years ago where someone interviewed founders of AI startups and then started asking questions and digging into their technology. And they found something ridiculous, like 80% of AI, of startups that have AI in their name, aren't doing anything that's technically AI. So keeping in mind that when companies talk about their own AI, it's typically in their best interest to make them sound very complicated and difficult to do, because that's what gives them the most barrier to entry and the best impression for knowing that only they can do this thing and no one else can. So keeping in mind that when we talk about AI gone wrong, we don't really know what's under the hood. Generative AI is pretty new. The paper that sort of started it all was published in 2017. So it's really only, what, like eight years old at this point. So I don't know that we've had any really big, well-known failings of generative AI yet, other than just what you see constantly being published about, like, it gave me a weird answer here, it didn't do this. But yeah, so as far as just if we're talking about AI in general, there's some really high-profile examples. There was a hospital, for example. I pulled up my notes to make sure that I didn't get the details wrong, because I've sort of been collecting examples for several years now. But one of the examples was there's a hospital that used an AI algorithm for informing their outreach. So they wanted to proactively outreach to people to get them in to see the doctor when it might be beneficial for them. And they did that by training it on the data they had, like who typically comes to see the doctor this often to get problems resolved or whatever. Well, they accidentally ended up building a system that discriminated against the lower income areas of their district, of the radius that they served, because it was people who didn't need the outreach who tended to come and get advice more often and therefore had better outcomes. And so I think this thing was in production for like a year and a half or 2 years before anyone noticed that it was amplifying the sort of systemic bias, which had a very large racial component to it that was already sort of baked into their current system. So they built an AI that amplified some of the worst parts of what they were already accidentally doing. And I've seen things like that constantly. It also gets interesting when you start to look at how AI interacts with the real world, for example, through sensors. So there's AI that's gotten really good at radiology, at finding cancer from x-rays or ultrasounds or CAT scans, things like that, or MRIs. One of them, for example, is diagnosing people with melanoma based on pictures of their skin. That tends to work a lot better for people with lighter skin. And it's partly because of the algorithms and the training data, which are better able to find the contrast. But what's also interesting to think about is it's also partly due to the hardware, to the cameras that are built and calibrated for certain contrast in certain skin types. And so there's a lot of really high profile failings where this AI can absolutely improve outcomes. Sometimes it improves outcomes that can amplify disparities.
So there's to restate that, it sounds like the AI is getting better, but it's getting better at maximizing and optimizing human systems. And we're training on human data. And if we assume that human data was even well-intentioned, has bias, that bias might sort of creep in, to your point about sort of the, we're looking at hardware that humans look at or cameras and trained on. Yeah. That's going to maximize that. We look at systems where we account for sort of patients who call more as, oh, that's a good sign because we think it's all fair and it's even. The reality, it's not. And the AI will just sort of pick up on that naturally and train against that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because even when you try to design it not to do that, for example, by collecting new data, there's a lot of sort of situational or socioeconomic conditions that can lead you to creating biased data even when you're trying not to. I think it was Sweden or Norway, I forget which country, it was one of the Scandinavian countries several years ago, wanted to improve their healthcare science by getting better at the genomics part. So they did a whole genome sequencing project for their population. And so what they did was they invited people to come in and have they invited citizens to come in and have their genome sequenced so that they could form a baseline that was specific to the ancestry of their citizens. Of course, it was only people of higher socioeconomic statuses that tended to have the free time during during work hours of a weekday when they were working to do the sequencing, when the workers were there to do the sequencing. And so only people from higher socioeconomic statuses were able to come in and get their genome sequence. And it was the average of them that then formed the baseline by which you compare everyone else's genome. And so it kind of goes to show you how difficult it is to get truly unbiased data.
Yeah, it's a great story. Ed, where do you?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So if I understand kind of what you said, neural networks are basically topologies of these interconnected perceptrons, mm-hmm. and the more capable they are, the less transparent they are, and so they become the combination of the network topology and the data used to train them. So as we think about an ecosystem being resilient, how should we think about leveraging AI to create greater stability at the ecosystem level? I mean, one of the questions going back in what you're talking about with, like, for example, melanoma detection, mm-hmm. I presume we're not wanting the system to be less capable of detecting melanoma in one group of potential patients. We just want to have a system that's trained maybe as separately in a way that allows it to maximize its utility across all these different disparate groups. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that is accurate. And actually, one of the things you said in there was really interesting about the sort of capability of our systems being inversely proportional to our ability to understand them. And I think that is largely true today, but I think that's incidental. Like, I don't think there's any sort of universal law that says that will always be true. And in fact, there are a lot of examples where the exact opposite is true. There are a lot of examples where, you know, I can make the best predictions by understanding, for example, the physical laws of nature and just programming those into the system. Like, I don't need AI. If I throw a ball, I don't need AI to tell me where the ball's likely to land. I can literally look at, like, I know gravity. I know the angle and trajectory it left my hand. I know wind resistance and drag. I can use all those variables to predict exactly where it's going to end up. That's how we, like, went to the moon. That's how NASA does a lot of their work, is they understand all the variables and you can just program them in. I think over time, we will understand these systems much better. We'll understand exactly how these neural networks, there's already several published research papers that have interesting ideas for how to introspect a neural network in a way that makes sense. And so I think that's incidental and current, but won't always be the case. And in fact, I think a lot of our advancements will get another, I think, huge bump up in advancement when we start to understand exactly why these systems work the way they work, and then can use that knowledge to improve them even further. And so for now, I think the way that we handle a lot of that is layering systems together. We can layer a generative AI with an expert system, with a linear regression, a number prediction model or something like that. So systemically, let's take the melanoma example. If we know that the AI system we created works better for people with lighter skin, then maybe the system is that you have more manual review for others to make sure that the outcome is equitable. And you can do that, again, by layering systems. I said layering different types of AI. It doesn't have to be AI. It can be layering AI with judgment and with human judgment, layering AI with people. And so I think there's a lot of things we can do to address that from a systemic level. It involves understanding the shortcomings of the particular technologies that we're using.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I appreciate that. So it's system engineering, but it doesn't mean that all the components of the system have to be artificial.
Yeah, we have a lot of technology at our disposal, and we have a lot of amazing minds and capabilities within our society as well. And so I think that's a big part of it, is continuing to understand how what we're doing gets integrated into the system. There's actually a really good book I read a couple years ago called Weapons of Math Destruction. And it talks about some of the essential elements of responsible implementation of AI. And one of the ones that I remembered very significantly is connecting algorithms to their outputs, making sure that the decisions that the algorithms are informing or making aren't disconnected from the algorithm itself. Like, there should be a feedback mechanism, essentially. If the algorithm says, do this thing, then there should be some way of then looking at what the outcome is and feeding that back into the system so that you can figure out when it's made bad calls, bad predictions.
And I think one of the things that maybe for our audience to sort of consider is that if you're integrating a new AI system, one, if your entire pipeline is dependent on one system, that might be a top risk. Or if you're not sort of following through with that final outcome and working it back, your AI might never sort of have the opportunity to improve, or you might never even see that it needs to be improved. I think the model, sort of the depends in depth model you keep sort of talking about, is if not one, then the other, sort of the Swiss cheese model in my mind. It passes through one layer of Swiss cheese through a hole, because that layer just has a hole there. Maybe the next layer won't at that spot. And while no system, no layer is perfect, together they serve as a full defense. So I know we're running low on time here, but I do want to sort of talk a little bit at sort of like the sort of the non-technical people. What would you recommend for those who are struggling to understand AI, to sort of get a sense for it broadly as an ecosystem? Where should they go? What should they do? How can we bridge that knowledge gap? Because we are heading into a sort of a much more AI-driven world, and I think everyone has an anxiety about being prepared for that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's sort of, we're heading into a world where being able to use AI is becoming table stakes for whatever you do, right? Like, it's in the same way that you pretty much can't get by today without being computer literate or having a smartphone. It's probably getting to the point where if you don't have the ability to use AI to help with various things, you're going to be left in the dust. You're not going to be able to keep up with where society is going. And whether you consider that good or bad is almost completely irrelevant. It's just the reality of the situation. One of the things that I think is really important is understanding. I think a lot of people will jump in. They'll sign up for ChatGPT, or they'll start using AI without knowing it. They'll use some app on their phone that helps them do something and not realize that under the hood, it's AI. They might not realize that part of what powers that app is that app in turn is calling the API of ChatGPT. Like, ChatGPT is the engine to the car, and they've never lifted the hood, so they wouldn't know what the engine is. And so I think one of the important things is recognizing how widespread AI is becoming, and also understanding that it's not infallible, that it can encode biases, that it doesn't think the way people do. And this is another big thing, is I think we have a hard time objectively evaluating the performance of different types of AI because we like to anthropomorphize everything. If an AI, especially a generative AI like ChatGPT, its whole thing is using language the way we do. Well, think about this. Your entire experience, your entire life learning and using language, 100% of your experience in using that language to communicate with people has been with the assumption that they think similarly to you. That when they say something, it's being informed by mental processes and ideas that are similar to the ones you have that result in you saying similar things. So if I say something to you that you completely agree with, and you go, oh yeah, that's, you smile and you say, that's exactly what I found. What you're smiling at is that shared experience. We've both experienced the same thing that have led us to similar conclusions. A GPT, a large language model, can tell you an exact same conclusion, and it did not have that experience. It did not have the sort of neural pathway, the neural firings in its brain that led to the same recollection of the experience, the same inference, the same conclusion, analysis and conclusions. All it's doing is it's mimicking language that's been used by other people who have had similar experiences. So it can end up, a lot of times it comes up with very confident and plausible sounding answers, but it's not using the same thought processes. It doesn't have any sort of emotions or feelings that motivate it to want to be truthful with you. It doesn't really have any concept of the truth. It just knows what people have said before that it's been trained on. And what's really interesting to me is bringing it back to the systemic question. I think a lot of people aren't thinking about its training data systemically. It's been trained on language, yes. But where does that language come from? It comes from forums. It comes from blog posts. It comes from published articles and literature. And it's forming that sort of attention. To bring it back to attention, it's figuring out how far away different words are from each other. What's really interesting is a word isn't just this many words away, but it's even further away if they're on two different pages. And even further away if they're on two different parts of the internet. Like a Reddit post is further away in that calculation than like peer-reviewed published article or a blog post. And so one of the things, I'm actually working on a blog post myself that talks about identifying bias, language bias in large language models based on the sort of network effects of its training data. And so my premise is, imagine that you ask it, you tell it, I have a wedding coming up. Can you recommend a high quality, fashionable men's dress shoe for me to buy? Now, imagine that I ask that question using language that's very similar to what real people on Reddit may ask in a small men's fashion subreddit. Imagine instead I ask the same question, but the particular words or the dialect or whatever that I use is more similar to blog spam. And now imagine the two different answers you'll get back from ChatGPT to the same question. If you were to ask me as a person, it doesn't matter what language you use to ask me. I have thoughts and ideas on what the best men's dress shoe is based on my experience. And I'll give you the same answer regardless of the specific words you use in your question. An LLM often will not. It will to some degree, but there's a limit to that degree. And so I actually have an example that I created where I did exactly that. And it recommended like five or six different shoes. And in each of the answers, there wasn't a single shoe that was common between the two. And so it's really interesting when you think about the systemic aspect. Like with the large language models, it's not just the words on the page, but how the pages are organized on the internet. And with the genomics example, it's not just getting a baseline of someone's genome. It's the socioeconomic factors that would motivate someone to actually come in and give you their genome. So it's really interesting when you sort of pull yourself a few dimensions above whatever the models are and think about how the systemic aspects can influence the AI. So sorry, that's hard for, I think, regular people to be expected to really truly think through and understand. The point was understanding that no matter the capability, these systems are fallible and often biased in ways that we may not be thinking. And so you always want to make sure that you're not attributing to them the thoughtfulness that you might attribute to another person giving you those answers.
That's fascinating. So in just thinking through all the topics we've covered today, I mean, it seems to me that we have this question of capability versus transparency. We have the issue that you described in looking at the genomic literature, which I think is kind of informative. You talked about the importance of consistency. I'm wondering, and so for me, I'm thinking like, as we think about, for example, applications of AI to education, one of the things that I've considered is the possibility that maybe the main role of the human in that and the educational role is actually to check the AI, to have the AI solve the problem and then grade it. And there might be a similar thing here in an ecosystem where we could combine, engineer human AI combinations that grade the output and bring the components that we care about, fairness or our equity, et cetera, in that by having this way that we're always looking and always considering it. It also seems that maybe the large language model might need to be a network of smaller focused models, because again, I think we don't want to have the system be really bad at detecting melanoma in light skin. We just want it to be more equitable in its ability to, we want to build systems that maximize the likelihood that it predicts in any situation, right? But to understand that there are inequalities there, and so we may need to augment it more with human AI partnership. I think this has been a fascinating discussion, and at the end, I'd love to hear just your final thoughts. Over to you, James.
Yeah, I think to your point, Ed, that discussion around sort of melanoma and attention were the two sort of takeaways. I really like this. As we've discussed on other episodes of this podcast, this anthropomorphism of AI comes with a bit of a downside in that people attribute a lot of understanding and experiential knowledge when it is not that at all. And that can cause some bias in how we build and how we use AI. And for business leaders out there, and for our audience and listeners, how you think about integrating these products. You really do have to think about the AI isn't smarter than you. It may actually, it's probably dumber in some contexts, and how you manage that risk. And if you are not managing it, if you're not thinking about it, you're doing it wrong. So some sort of reflection that, okay, how do we catch when the AI is wrong? Being thoughtful about that half the equation is important in business, particularly as we head from this hype cycle down into the, we move fast and break things. We're in the move fast part. We haven't gotten to the break things part. As Steve, you mentioned, I think before the call, I love that framing. So how do we get ahead of that break things? How do we prevent that from going really poorly for humanity? So really great conversation. Again, thank you for being here with us. Steve, any parting thoughts?
Yeah, this has been a great discussion. Thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I think one of the big things will figuring out how AI continues to advance and sort of change the society that we've built as we integrate it more and more. I think one of the main concerns will be continuing to think about appropriateness of applicability, what different technologies are good at, what they're not good at, and being able to plan appropriately. For example, we've talked about a lot about large language models potentially giving answers that are factually incorrect. But there's a lot of things that you can use a large language model that aren't falsifiable. There are things that have no right or wrong answer. Asking a large language model, for example, to give you 5 ideas for a new book plot, like there's no wrong answer there. It might give you plots that you think are good or bad. It might largely give plots that have been done to death, because it is, after all, learning from everything that's been published so far. But at the end of the day, there's no wrong answer to a sort of creative output. And so understanding what it can help you with and in what maybe it can't, or what has more landmines that might be there to discover versus what wouldn't have any, because there's no real bad thing that can come from this. I think that'll be a large part of it, is just really the more general sense of applicability of different technologies. And I think that's going to have to become something we teach. In the same way that we have computer classes that teach people how to type and whatnot, I think going forward, people are going to need to understand, at least on some level, what the capabilities are of these different technologies that are becoming unavoidable, that they're becoming parts of the decision to provide you healthcare or not, or to provide you unemployment or not, or to just give you better customer service for a broken toy that you bought or not. We're going to have some sort of base level of understanding of these things, I think, going forward, given how much they've already sort of penetrated our society and our different systems we've set up.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at socialmorks.com.